Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn today's meeting to Benjamin Haynes. You may begin.
Thank you, Rebecca. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's briefing on the new burden estimates for Clostridium difficile infections in the United States. We are joined by Dr. Michael Bell, the Deputy Director of CDC's Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, and Mr. Christian Lillis, the Founder and Executive Director of the Peggy Lillis Memorial Foundation. Dr. Bell and Mr. Lillis will provide opening remarks before taking your questions. But before turning it over to Dr. Bell, I want to remind you that all materials are embargoed until 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I will now turn it over to Dr. Bell.
Thanks, Ben, and welcome to everybody on the phone today. We're here to discuss new data regarding Clostridium difficile, or C. difficile as it's also known. C. difficile is a bacteria that causes severe diarrhea and damage to the colon and is often triggered by exposure to antibiotics. Infections with C. difficile have become increasingly common over the last few decades and are seen in patients in healthcare facilities as well as people in their communities. Today, CDC is reporting in a New England Journal of Medicine article that in a single year, C. difficile caused nearly 500,000 infections and thousands of deaths. In the past, patients infected with C. difficile have had diarrhea related to antibiotic use that was often perceived as a nuisance, but not a major problem. Unfortunately, the type of C. difficile circulating in the U.S. today produces such a powerful toxin that it can cause a truly deadly diarrhea. Patients receiving antibiotics are now at risk for not just a mild diarrhea, but intense illness that can include damage to the bowels so painful and severe that part of the colon needs to be surgically removed, a condition called toxic megacolon. Many patients who recover still suffer multiple relapses. In fact, about 1 out of 5 patients have at least one relapse that requires further treatment. This is a very severe illness that causes tremendous suffering and death. C. difficile infection is caused by the combination of taking antibiotics and being exposed to the C. difficile bacteria. Antibiotics damage the normal bacteria in a person's intestines and create the opportunity for C. difficile to take over. Once infected with C. difficile, it can be very difficult to restore the normal balance of intestinal bacteria that's needed for health. Unfortunately, C. difficile is very easy to spread. The bacteria form a durable spore that can contaminate hands or the environment, so that any breach in correct glove use, hand hygiene, or cleaning protocols can allow the spores to spread. Because hand sanitizers, don't kill spores, it's essential that you thoroughly wash your hands with soap and water to remove them. This is one reason why we recommend glove use when caring for patients with C. difficile, to make it easier to maintain good hand hygiene. There's no room for error. Today's article gives us a better picture of where C. difficile infections are happening. In both nursing homes and hospitals, we're seeing similar numbers of infections, about 100,000 infections in each. Although people receiving care in hospitals made up two-thirds of all C. difficile infections, two-thirds of those actually occurred after the patient went home. It's essential that patients and their clinicians be aware that they need to take any diarrhea following antibiotic use very seriously. People of all ages get C. difficile, but about 65% of healthcare-associated C. difficile infections and 80% of the deaths that occur because of it happen in people 65 years of age or older. In fact, 1 out of 9 patients over 65 years old with healthcare-associated C. difficile infection dies within 30 days of diagnosis. That's a frightening statistic. This study also shows that more than 150,000 infections reported were community-associated, meaning they had no documented inpatient hospital exposure. Nonetheless, as we showed in another recent CDC study, 80% of patients with community-associated C. difficile infections did in fact have contact with a healthcare setting, like a doctor's office or a dental clinic. And that was generally during the 3 months right before their diagnosis. Most of those patients were also given antibiotics. Overall, there are two main things that need to be improved. Number one is how antibiotics are being used, making sure that we use them when they're truly necessary and only for as long as necessary. Of course, we always want patients to receive the life-saving antibiotics they need without delay. We don't want anyone to be at risk for sepsis or other complications, but we also want to be sure that these essential medications are used correctly. The second element is to ensure rigorous infection control in all healthcare settings. C. difficile infections must be diagnosed quickly and correctly so that the infected patient can be cared for using the right infection control techniques. This includes cleaning the environment near the patient with the right spore-killing disinfectants, ensuring perfect hand hygiene all the time, and also letting facilities know when a patient with C. difficile is about to be transferred to them so that they too can use the right infection control practices. CDC has taken a number of steps to stop the rise of C. difficile infections. First, we're working to ensure that healthcare personnel follow current evidence-based strategies that prevent the spread of C. difficile from one patient to another. Thanks to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, Hospital Inpatient Quality Reporting Program, hospitals have been required to report C. difficile infections to CDC's National Healthcare Safety Network since 2013. This now lets us track and report the nation's progress in controlling this disease. So far, we've seen at least a 10% reduction in infections since 2011. However, more needs to be done. Beginning in 2017, C. difficile prevention will also be included in CMS's value-based purchasing program, also known as pay-for-performance. In preparation for that, CDC is using a targeting strategy that identifies which hospitals are having infection issues so that we and our partners in state and local health departments and agencies like CMS can deliver assistance where it's needed most. To reduce the majority of C. difficile infections, we will need to improve how antibiotics are being prescribed in hospitals and throughout healthcare. If we can improve antibiotic prescribing, we expect to see rates of C. difficile infections improve dramatically. We believe this because, for example, in England, over a 3-year period, they were able to push C. difficile infection rates down by over 60% just by doing a better job of managing how antibiotics are used. In the United States, we have the National Strategy to Combat Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria, a strategy that includes a focus on improving antibiotic prescribing and use, or antibiotic stewardship, as it's also known. In addition, the strategy addresses more surveillance for outbreak detection, and robust prevention activities in all 50 states and major cities. These efforts have a potential to cut C. difficile infections in half, and the proposed funding in the President's FY16 budget would allow CDC to dramatically ramp up C. difficile prevention efforts by supporting specific antibiotic resistance prevention programs in healthcare facilities across the nation. The programs are intended to improve both antibiotic prescribing as well as infection control practices. Finally, there will likely be some C. difficile infections that continue to happen even with implementation of antibiotic stewardship and great infection control. And there's a need for ongoing innovation and discovery of new technologies and strategies that will help us address those remaining infections. Examples of this kind of innovation includes research on the human microbiome, understanding the complex relationship of bacteria that make up a healthy human colon. Also improving the role of patients who may carry C. difficile without having symptoms, how many there are, and how much they contribute to the transfer of infection within communities and hospitals. In addition, there is a need to better understand approaches to cleaning healthcare environments, whether it's through new technologies or new targeted strategies, so that we can ensure that the environment doesn't create an opportunity for transmission. And then finally, understanding how C. difficile moves in community settings outside of healthcare, and making sure that we're able to diagnose C. difficile as quickly and accurately as possible. Finally, when we look into the future, there's also the possibility of new vaccines that can prevent C. difficile infection altogether. So as we look forward, there are many potential opportunities for innovation that we continue to pursue. At the end of the day, we have enough information now on these devastating infections to realize that the time to act is well upon us, and failing to act would be disastrous. I'll conclude my remarks, and we'll be happy to take questions at the end of the teleconference. I hope I've conveyed just how dangerous and concerning this infection is, and the primary actions that we have to take to keep them from harming more patients and taking more lives. I'd like to introduce now Mr. Christian Lillis, founder of the Peggy Lillis Memorial Foundation. I wish it was under more positive circumstances that we had him with us today, but I'm very honored that he's here to share his personal experience and the work he's doing to turn a family tragedy into action and raise awareness to prevent C. difficile from hurting others.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Like most Americans, I was unaware of C. diff's existence until it killed my mother, Peggy Lillis, on April 21st of 2010. My mother was an extraordinary person. From the age of 25, she was a single mother of two sons. We were on welfare for a while as Mom attended college to become a kindergarten teacher. Nothing made her happier than educating children. Unlike the majority of C. diff victims, my mother was only 56 years old and in good health. She had not been hospitalized since she gave birth to my brother in 1976. Her case, like the tens of thousands newly recognized in the study, was community acquired. We can't be sure exactly where or when my mother was colonized by C. diff, but her dentist prescribing clindamycin for a root canal procedure precipitated her illness and death. Her dentist didn't warn her that C. diff was a possible side effect. So when Mom came down with diarrhea early one Friday morning, she assumed, as did we, that it was stomach flu. Because the diarrhea was so severe, she called her doctor that weekend. He prescribed a strong anti-diarrhea medication by phone without examining her. When her symptoms persisted on Monday, she called him again and was referred to a GI doctor. That Tuesday, fearing she was badly dehydrated, we took Mom to the emergency room. It was there that I first heard the words Clostridium difficile. Less than 36 hours later, despite the hospital's best efforts, including extensive antibiotics, IV immunoglobulin, and a surgical subtotal colectomy, my mother was dead. Our grief was epic. Mom was one of nine siblings from an Irish Catholic family in Brooklyn. It felt like our entire community was in mourning as more than 500 people attended her funeral. We struggled for weeks to understand how our mother could die from a disease that we'd never heard of. We studied C. diff and learned it causes thousands and thousands of deaths every year. Fueled by our outrage and the outpouring of love for her, we started the Peggy Lillis Memorial Foundation in July 2010. Since then, we have worked diligently to raise awareness, educate the public, and increasingly to shape policy. I'm grateful to CDC for increasing our understanding of the true burden of this disease. That's critical to reducing the death and harm it causes. It is my sincere hope that this new, more comprehensive assessment of C. diff's impact will spark much greater attention from the press, the healthcare industry, and lawmakers. Greater public awareness about C. diff's prevalence, risk factors, prevention, and treatment is absolutely crucial so Americans can make informed decisions and seek help early. It's also incumbent on all of us to translate this awareness into tangible policy changes that we know will save lives. That's why Peggy Lillis Foundation advocates for robust antibiotic stewardship, sanitation, and hand hygiene programs at every healthcare facility, mandatory public reporting in every state, and increased public and private investment in both prevention and treatment for all antibiotic-resistant infections, including C. diff. Lastly, the numbers in this new study of 450,000 infections and 29,000 deaths are big, often abstract numbers. It's important to keep in mind the actual people behind them. Every day, we hear from citizens whose lives have been irrevocably changed by C. diff. People like Sarah, whose virulent C. diff infection left her unable to conceive a child. People like Jess, who has had 13 recurrences. People like the parents of 5-month-old Molly. And families like the Dexters, the Adamses, the Mulligans, and tens of thousands more who have lost a loved one to this disease. As you write and speak about C. diff, please keep them in mind and help us to amplify their voices. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Rebecca, we're ready to take questions.
Thank you. We'll begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question now, please press star 1. Please remember to unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. I'll introduce you by name. To withdraw a request, you could press star 2. We'll wait just another moment for questions. Our first question comes from Liz Zabel, U.S. Today. You may ask your question.
Hi. I was just wondering if you can talk about how resistant these infections are. Are antibiotics still usually effective, or are you seeing growing rates of antibiotic resistance?
So antibiotics can be effective, but I think it's important to realize that there's more to it than just treating this infection with an antibiotic. The problem with the infection is that, especially if it goes unrecognized, the toxins can create so much damage that it's not just about the organism being there, but also about the damage to the colon leading to leakage into the bloodstream and sepsis and other terrible outcomes. So there's the treatment issue. There's also the fact that once somebody gets Clostridium difficile, and I'll ask Dr. Cliff McDonald to also say a few words about this, once you have C. difficile, it usually means your normal bacteria in your bowels are so damaged that returning to normal can be very difficult. So even if you have an antibiotic that kills the C. difficile, it can come back very easily, hence the relapses that Mr. Lillis also described. Cliff, do you want to say a word?
Yeah, just say something. Many people have this question of why do we talk about C. difficile as an antibiotic resistant organism when the main antibiotics used to treat it, there is not clear resistance to those. I won't even go into what those are right now, but what Dr. Bell is saying is exactly right, that although there is not resistance against the drugs used to treat it, the actions of antibiotics are principal in this infection. As we've heard already, it's the disruption of the normal microbiota in the intestine that leads to vulnerability. There is some other resistance that occurs in this organism, and the epidemic strain that emerged over 10 years ago that is responsible for a lot of this increase in severity is resistant to a commonly used class of antibiotics, and that's one way that strain may have become more successful over other strains. So there's many elements of antibiotic resistance except for this important part that we always think about first, is that the infection will be less treatable. That's not clearly the center of this, but antibiotics clearly are driving this whole epidemic.
Next question, please, Rebecca.
Our next question comes from Mike Stobe with the Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Dr. McDonald just referred to the strain that emerged over 10 years ago, the more severe strain. I was just wondering, is that continuing to be the most severe strain, or are there different strains out there, and is the balance of which one's predominating changing at all? And also, is there any changes in the severe strain itself that bode either good or bad news for us?
Thanks, Mike. I think Dr. McDonald will be the expert on the ecology of the organism. I will say that the fact that the very severe strain producing toxins has spread across the country means that we have to take all potential infections with C. difficile with the same seriousness. But Cliff, do you want to say a word?
Yeah, Dr. Bell, that's exactly right. We do have to take every infection with all seriousness and look at each individual patient. That's the best foreteller of how someone will do. The epidemic strain, the BI NAP1 strain that emerged actually back in the year 2000, first in the Pittsburgh area and then Montreal, it has spread globally now. It is now accounting in, Dr. Lessa can correct me, it's approximately 30% in this study that we're talking about today, 30% across the land. It's a little higher in healthcare facilities than in the community. It is more easily transmitted than other strains, it appears. It also does appear to cause more severe disease. We haven't noticed any specific changes to that strain. But globally, there are other strains like it that have emerged that appear to have increased virulence or severity and some of the other factors as well. So it's not just unique to this strain, although this is the strain that is causing most of the more severe disease in the United States. Dr. Lester, do you have anything to add to that?
No, that's perfect, Cliff. And it was the most prevalent strain in that we observed across C. difficile infections, both in the community as well as in healthcare.
Next question, please, Rebecca.
Our next question comes from Yasmin Abitel with Reuters.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was just wondering what the current detection and diagnosis methods are for C. difficile and whether there are shortcomings there.
Yeah, we're in a transition point as a nation in terms of how we diagnose the disease. The good news is we have a more sensitive detection method, and that is gradually taking over from the old methods in clinical settings across the country. Again, I'll defer to Dr. McDonald in terms of the specific details about the tests and the sensitivities therein.
Yes, the IDSA guidelines of 2010, which CDC was, some of us were co-authors on, did call for the use of more sensitive diagnostics, and something that we have been encouraging here at CDC in recommending. I think that the best way to sum it up is this, that we need to use better methods overall in diagnosing C. difficile, and that includes right at the basics of determining who should be tested. There is no diagnostic test that makes the diagnosis for you. It's a combination of the clinical symptoms of the patient, their situation, and a laboratory test. The old tests that were commonly being used all the time were the enzyme amino assays, and they generally were not felt to be sensitive enough. The nucleic acid amplification tests, or otherwise known as PCR tests, are now being more and more used. In this study, and Dr. Lester can correct me again also, but I believe it was around 50% of all the labs, or 50% at least of all the cases, were diagnosed with the nucleic acid amplification tests. They are much more sensitive. There is some controversy about sometimes that they're too sensitive, but it so much depends upon how you use them. If you use a very sensitive test but are very selective in how you decide it should be used or who to test, it's a very good way to diagnose diseases in general. If you use highly sensitive tests indiscriminately, you'll end up over-diagnosing the infection. We're very aware of this issue, and we take measures to control for this factor when we look over time, and when we report data on hospital rates, we take into account the type of tests they're using, so that in the case of hospitals who are trying to perform better, they're not unduly penalized for using a more sensitive test. But we're also cognizant that over time we may see some counter movement, that cases might just go up because you're using more sensitive tests when you're really doing a better job in preventing the disease. And so we're taking that into account and looking at that. And we did in this study also. Dr. Lester, do you want to say something about how if people were using more sensitive tests 100% of the time, you would even see a different rate?
Yeah, so the national burden presented on this New England Journal of Medicine upcoming publication is take into account the type of the diagnostic test. Also, in the paper, we present scenarios where you have hypothetical scenarios where no labs in the U.S. would be using that, how that estimated vary from zero use of the PCR, or more sensitive test, up to 100% of laboratories using those more sensitive assays. So that's in the upcoming publication that you all have received the copy of the paper.
Next question, please, Rebecca.
Next question, Evan Brown, Fox News Radio.
Hi, thank you for taking the question. I realize this may have been answered in one way before, but could you describe what kind of care someone with C. difficile has to go through and what they, not necessarily the short term, but as you mentioned, it's sort of a long-term thing or they can have a relapse. So what does a person do if they have C. difficile? How do they live? Do they have to see their doctor regularly? Do they have to have regular checkups for this? What's the long-term care?
Sure, that's a great question. So first and foremost, what we want to have happen is for people who have had antibiotics, if they get diarrhea, to immediately talk to their clinician and make sure they're tested appropriately to see if they have C. difficile. If they do, then they can be given treatment using oral antibiotics to control the infection. That's the standard approach that's been used for some time and is often successful, but not always. And what we've seen is that for many patients, there can be multiple rounds of antibiotics required to finally suppress the infection and, with luck, give the body enough time to go back to normal in terms of the bacteria in the gut. The challenge that we have is that by giving antibiotics, in many ways, we're continuing to disturb the normal bacteria in the bowel, so it's not a perfect solution. The challenge arises when you have a toxin-forming type of C. difficile, where your colon becomes so damaged that it is, A, very painful, and, B, puts your life at risk because it starts leaking potentially dangerous bacteria into the bloodstream. And when that happens, it's not just a matter of a frustrating long course of infection and recurrent treatment, but it's also a matter of going in and having the damaged part of the colon actually removed. So now not only do you have the frustration of the infection, but you have the very real issue of becoming a surgical patient with a missing part of colon. That definitely changes your life because now you'll have a diversion, as they call it, where your bowels have to empty into a bag, a colostomy bag, and it may be years before things can be reattached appropriately. So it's a devastating impact on a human being's life. One of the things that holds out some promise, and you may have heard about, is fecal transplantation. What we know is that returning the bowel to its normal state in terms of the types and variety of bacteria that live there normally is one way that we can return a person to health. And the sooner that happens, the less likely they are to have recurrences of C. difficile infection. So originally this was sort of a last-ditch desperation-type treatment. I think increasingly we're seeing it move earlier into the process. I'm going to hand it over again to our C. difficile expert, Dr. Cliff McDonald, to say a little bit more about the microbiome issue.
Yeah, no, I think that is exactly right, and it's a range of outcomes and a range of problems. Some people do just fine with the antibiotic treatment that Dr. Bell mentioned. It is a problem that we're using an antibiotic to treat a disease that really occurs because someone got an antibiotic in the first place. It just so happens, of course, the antibiotics we use to treat them are active against the C. difficile organism, but they're also, just like any antibiotic, disrupting the normal ecology in the bowel, and that leads to 1 in 5 individuals across the board getting recurrences. And also some individuals not even going to the point of recurrence, but even dying or losing their colon in the initial disease. But there's also a large subset that do fine with the first treatment, and they get over it. And it's usually 10 days of the antibiotic treatment. It's frustrating. You hear this a lot, that it often takes several days for the diarrhea to get better. And sometimes the diarrhea is very, very severe. In fact, it is generally a severe disease, the diarrhea. I shouldn't say just sometimes. C. difficile marks itself that way as being a more severe diarrhea. The most severe cases, people are having bowel movements almost continuously or 10 times a day, just miserable during those days in the acute illness. and often 6 days required to see to start to see a real recovery from that diarrhea. And but then most of them still do go on and resolve and don't recur. But 1 in 5 will recur, and some of those then go on to this multiple recurrent cycle that results in people getting fecal transplants and whatnot.
I just want to further clarify my question. What, if someone has this infection and they go through their first round of having C. difficile, and they is there anything they can do to prevent a recurrence? I'm talking about lifestyle. I'm talking about prevention. What does the patient do, or is there nothing they can do?
Well, the big thing, of course, is not to take antibiotics if they're not prescribed, and that making sure that your clinician know that you've had C. difficile in the past, that antibiotics taken in that recovery phase, especially the weeks after recovering from the C. difficile infection, increases the likelihood of having a recurrence. And so this would be antibiotics for some other condition. Of course, antibiotics are life-saving. If they have to be given, they're given. Some people would say, well, can we take probiotics? Are there anything like that yet? Not at this time. There's plenty of probiotics on that market, of course. They're sold as nutritional supplements. None of them have an FDA indication for specifically preventing C. difficile. It's a little bit of a shot in the dark. Generally, for most people, those probiotics are going to be safe, and they can take them. They can take yogurt, whatever, but we can't at this point in time give a clear recommendation of which one to take and how to take it. I think hopefully that will change in the future. Other than avoiding antibiotics, I think there are certainly general things, taking a diverse diet. We know that, we don't know yet, but we know a little bit to know that dietary diversity probably helps with a diverse microbiome and things like that. But the big thing is probably avoiding unnecessary antibiotics and not pushing for antibiotics if they're not truly needed.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Next question comes from Tara Tarantino with Cronkite News.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, is C. difficile more prevalent in a certain area of the country? Do we have any state numbers on this?
That's a great question, and I think the work that Dr. Lessa has done might shed some light on that. Fernanda?
Sure, absolutely. So this study was done across 10 U.S. states, and we saw some states that had higher numbers of community-associated C. difficile infection and other states with higher numbers of healthcare-associated infections. So in particular, Minnesota was the state with the highest incidence of community-associated C. difficile infection. And on the healthcare-associated infection side, New York was the state with the highest rate of healthcare-associated infection.
Can I just jump in here, too? This is Dr. McDonald again. This paper was, this study that we're talking about was performed in our Emerging Infections Program. It's these 10 sites that its strength is it gives us the opportunity to see the full continuum of where these infections occur, including these community-associated cases. However, we also have the National Healthcare Safety Network that where we get data from hospitals in all 50 states. And so there you can actually find, if you're from some other state that was not involved in these, was not one of these 10 regions that was included in the Emerging Infections Program, you can actually go to the Hospital Compare website. Or actually, I should say even simpler and more straightforward, look at our recent progress report on the CDC website, where in hospital rates of C. difficile or performance or levels of infection are reported from all 50 states. That's called our standardized infection ratio. So if you're interested specifically in where a particular region is affected, at least from a hospital standpoint, that's available as well.
Rebecca, we have time for two more questions.
Our next question comes from Elizabeth Mishkati with Internal Medicine News.
Hi. You mentioned that medical and dental offices are one source of community-acquired infections, and I wondered, how do you know anything about how it's getting transmitted in the offices and what doctors can do to reduce that risk, like better hand washing or...
Right, so that's a great question. Certainly in all healthcare settings, we want all healthcare professionals to be meticulous about hand hygiene, not just for C. diff, but for, you know, countless reasons. And so that's a basic part of correct medical practice. But remember that C. difficile is special in that there are two steps to becoming infected. There's one, you have to be exposed to the spore or the bacterium, and that can certainly happen in healthcare settings. But also, you need to be given antibiotics so that you can open the path for the C. difficile to take hold. And, you know, I think what we saw was that the exposure in outpatient medical settings and dental clinics seemed to also correlate with the antibiotic piece of that as well. So it's not entirely clear that this was where they actually were exposed to the bacteria. This may have been mainly where they were exposed to the antibiotic that let the bacteria take hold. But I'll also check, Dr. Lessa, do you have additional details that you want to add to that?
No, Dr. Mike Bell, that was perfect, and you're absolutely right that the outpatient setting can be the place where the patient can get exposed to the antibiotics or can be exposed to the C. difficile spore. And that there has been publications that showed identification of C. difficile spores on those outpatient settings. Dr. McDonald, do you want to add anything?
You mean they found it in the actually found it in the settings?
Yeah, I'll just jump in here, Dr. Lessa. Yes, there's a study from the VA, VA clinics, where patients who recently were discharged from the hospital and they had maybe had C. diff while they were in the hospital, they recovered from their diarrhea, but they continued to shed these spores for weeks to a couple months after resolution of the diarrhea. And so they found that, yes, in fact, examination tables and other ambulatory sites were contaminated with C. difficile spores. So that is something that we're very interested in understanding is as Dr. Bell, you know, laid it out, is it the exposure to the antibiotics, they received the prescription in the doctor's or dentist's office, that led them to be vulnerable to C. difficile, or was it also that they were exposed to the spores in that setting? And what should we do about that if that's the case? And so there's actually a study ongoing right now, again, in this emerging infections program that we have ongoing, a case control study, to look at risk factors in the community for C. difficile to better understand, especially that, the role of healthcare exposures. And how that may play a role and what we should be doing about that.
And this is Mike Bell again. Just to clarify, these studies that we're talking about today, they're undertaken in a number of locations around the country, but these particular studies don't include every last state. So when we talk about where we had high rates and low rates, please do bear in mind that those are amongst the participants. The information that Dr. McDonald pointed you towards earlier on the CDC website for our national reports is a better place to look at data representing sort of national pictures in terms of where these things are being found.
Last question, please, Rebecca.
Take our last question from Jill Donru with CBS Miami.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to make this real quick. Are you talking about all antibiotics, or are you talking about a certain class of antibiotics like fluoroquinolones?
That's a very good question. I'm afraid it's not as easy as saying one class is bad. As we look more closely at the bewildering number of bacteria that are supposed to live in your colon, what we're realizing is that probably as many as 70% of them have never been grown and never even been named before. There's a huge amount that we're able to do now with our advanced technology that's shedding light on this issue. and common antibiotics like vancomycin, for example, which ironically can be used to treat C. difficile, also does a tremendously effective job of wiping out some of these hidden bacteria that we think might be very important in terms of maintaining the normal state of the bowel and preventing C. difficile. Suffice to say, any antibiotic that we take can disrupt the normal microbial flora, and when that happens, we believe there's risk. Again, I'm going to ask Dr. McDonald to weigh in on this as well.
I don't have anything to add. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Thank you, Mr. Lewis, and everybody else that answered questions. This is going to conclude today's briefing. I want to remind you that all materials are embargoed until 5 p.m. Eastern. A transcript will be available at www.cdc.gov/media. And if you have further questions, please email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for attending today's conference. You may now disconnect.